Today's episode is brought to you by Audible.com. Audible carries over 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice by going to www.audible.com/undisclosed. This week's episode is also brought to you by The Great Courses. Now, as we all know, learning doesn't stop after we finish school. That's why I love The Great Courses, a really engaging video and audio lecture series. Now, if you know anything about me or you follow me on social media, you know that I am all about food and I cook a lot. I'm a pretty prolific and proficient home cook, I must say, but I am no gourmet. That's why I really enjoyed watching the Everyday Gourmet cooking collection from The Great Courses, which includes The Essential Secrets of Spices in Cooking, Making Healthy Food Taste Great, Baking Pastries and Desserts, and Making Great Meals in Less Time. It was filmed in partnership with the CIA, which is the Culinary Institute of America, and these lecture series offer tools and tips from a master chef to enhance your cooking skills. Now, The Great Courses is celebrating the 25th anniversary. They've got over 500 courses on lots of different subjects, and I really want you to give them a shot. So, for a limited time, The Great Courses has a special offer for undisclosed listeners. You can order any one of these four The Everyday Gourmet courses for just $9.95. This $9.95 price is only available for a limited time, so order today. Go to thegreatcourses.com/undisclosed. Again, that's thegreatcourses.com/undisclosed. This week's episode is also brought to you by EverAlbum. Have you ever run out of space on your phone? If you're anything like me and take way too many pictures of your cat, you probably have. But now you can have unlimited storage. Check out EverAlbum, a free mobile app that automatically protects your photos on your phone. You can easily sync your phone's camera roll, Facebook, Instagram, and Dropbox accounts so your pictures are always protected. Exclusively for Undisclosed listeners, EverAlbum is offering unlimited photo storage for free. Go to everalbum.com/undisclosed and download on iOS today. Hi, and welcome to episode 13 of Undisclosed, The State versus Adnan Syed. This week's episode is Bearing Witness. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and national security fellow, and I blog at splitthemoon.com. I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Volkov Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs The View from LL2. And Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor at the Evidence Prof blog. Now, when we last left off in the chronology of the case, Adnan had been arrested on February 28th, and he was denied bail shortly thereafter. But even before his arrest, the grand jury proceedings that would eventually lead to his indictment had already begun. And a number of witnesses that were Adnan's friends, including my brother Saad, were subpoenaed by the state to come and testify before the grand jury, which was held in March. They all testified favorably for Adnan in the sense that no one really offered any negative information about him, but there was only one witness that actually had information that was relevant to January 13th and that was helpful to Adnan's case. But by the time the trial rolled around, the person with this very important testimony, a community member named Bilal, had disappeared. Today we'll explore why he never made it to the trial, but first we will begin by walking through what a grand jury proceeding is.
So in the criminal justice realm, you have the prosecutor charging the defendant in a case, and we don't simply take the prosecutor at his or her word. Those charges have to be based upon probable cause. So the role of the grand jury is to either confirm or dispel the prosecutor's claim of probable cause. Grand jury proceedings are secretive, and grand jurors are much like trial jurors. They're chosen from the community. Unlike at a trial, though, there's no jury selection. In fact, defense counsel plays no role. There's, in fact, no judge before the grand jury. It's the prosecutor, the witness, the grand jurors, and a court reporter. Prosecutor can present whatever evidence he or she wants. There's no duty to present exculpatory evidence. So if someone else confessed to the crime, the prosecutor wouldn't have to present that. There's no right to cross-examination. Hearsay, although it can't be presented at trial, can be admitted before the grand jury. The exclusionary rule doesn't apply. Statements taken in violation of Miranda or without a search warrant, evidence that is seized can be introduced. So basically the theory is the grand jury is supposed to be a check against overreaching by the prosecutor. The problem is in modern times, it's not really effective at all for many of the reasons I discussed before. In 98 to 99% of cases, grand jurors return what's known as a true bill. That leads to the indictment and allows the case to proceed to trial. Now, that might be a little bit different from the popular perception you see in the media recently with the cases of police shootings and police officers not being indicted. But the classic quote on this comes from Judge Sol Wachler. He was in New York and he was quoted famously in The Bonfire of the Vanities as saying a grand jury would indict a ham sandwich. And that's pretty much how these things work. It's pretty much a lower hurdle the prosecution has to jump over, and it's secretive. It's not really a guard against the excesses of prosecutors. It's pretty much a rubber stamp that allows almost any defendant to be indicted.
In Maryland, the grand jury also has power to issue subpoenas and conduct discovery. What happens in effect, though, is that the police use this as their discovery tool, because the police cannot issue subpoenas in the same way that the grand jury can. So although we have many subpoenas in this case that were issued to various people and organizations, and they're issued in the name of the grand jury and signed by the grand jury foreman, in reality, it's the police conducting that discovery and using those grand jury subpoenas as their own tool. This seems to be pretty common practice in Baltimore and Maryland in general. It's not unusual for this to happen, even though it was not the original intent of the grand jury system. But what was least unusual in this case, and what we've touched on before, is how even after the grand jury had indicted Adnan and the grand jury no longer had any power to issue subpoenas, the police continued to use those grand jury subpoenas to obtain information in investigating Adnan's case.
At the time that witnesses were called to testify before the grand jury, Adnan was actually still represented by Chris Floor and Doug Colbert. But they had begun exploring other attorneys to take over the case and prepare for the trial. One of those attorneys that was highly recommended by both of those lawyers was Christina Gutierrez. She was very well respected, but she initially entered the scene not as Adnan's attorney. She entered the scene as Bilal's attorney and also my brother Saad's attorney, because Saad also did testify at the grand jury.
And you know, we got asked a lot of questions about this. Chris and Doug were involved in the Lawyers at Bail project, so they were always intended only to handle bail and pretrial detention issues. There was never any thought that they would continue to represent Adnan beyond the bail decision.
And Robbie, it's worth noting that the reason your brother needed an attorney and ended up hiring Gutierrez was because the police were threatening to charge him.
Yeah, that's true. We're going to hear from Saad another time, but as they were doing the investigation, they did talk to him, I believe, once, maybe twice, but it was not a pleasant interaction, and he felt very threatened and uncomfortable. But also, everybody advised them that if you're going to be testifying, you have to have a lawyer. You cannot just, show up without an attorney. This is just one of your basic fundamental rights anyways. But also, they did not want to be manipulated by the state.
Of course, the state used that against them. Or at least against Adnan, by claiming that they needed more time to investigate, more time before they could have the bail hearing, because all the Muslims were refusing to talk without an attorney, and therefore they were delayed by that.
So, Colin, just to clarify, during the testimony Saad and Bilal gave, although when you said defense counsel's not present, that means Adnan's defense attorneys were not present, but they had their attorney there. So Christina Gutierrez was present during their own testimony, correct?
Right. The reason we have notes from, for instance, the grand jury testimony by Bilal is, right, she was representing him, and therefore he wasn't the target of the grand jury. And as such, she could give him counsel. But the attorneys representing Adnan at the time did not have the right or the ability to be present to hear what the witnesses were saying before the grand jury.
Do they get that right later, or are they never afforded that right before trial?
Well, basically, in terms of grand jurors, what we know is that, again, grand jury proceedings are secretive and that evidence is generally not going to be disclosed. But of course, grand jury witnesses become witnesses at trial. And we've mentioned before the Jenks Act and Jenks Carr. If those grand jury witnesses testify at trial, absolutely, at the latest after direct examination, but often much earlier, the defense is entitled to transcripts of what those witnesses said before the grand jury.
The defense never got copies of those in this trial. We don't know why. It's very possible that Gutierrez just didn't ever ask for it. But either way, those transcripts were never handed over, even though the prosecution had an obligation under Jinks to provide them.
There were actually notes in Gutierrez's file that I saw recently where she had an assistant request the videotape proceedings from the grand jury a number of times, and it's unclear. I assume that they actually never received them. Now, when Bilal and Saad were subpoenaed to testify for the grand jury, I know that Gutierrez filed something called a motion to quash. They were trying to avoid appearing. So, Colin, can you explain that a bit?
Yeah, so if you get subpoenaed, for instance, to testify before the grand jury or to produce certain documents, you can file a motion to quash, and that means basically to have the subpoena rendered void or invalid. There are basically two grounds under which witness subpoenaed would seek to quash it. One is lack of relevance, simply, I know nothing relevant that would be helpful one way or the other with regard to the case. The other is on grounds of privilege, and there are several evidentiary privileges. You could have, say, a spousal privilege, attorney-client privilege, and most often the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination that you're making me the target of this grand jury and questioning me, and I'm concerned that something I say could eventually be used against me, whether it has to do with this case or not.
We don't know who all testified before the grand jury in this case. We have names of some of the people that appeared, but it may or may not be complete. However, we know for certain that the following people were called and did testify before the grand jury in addition to Bilal: Saad, Rabia's brother; Yasser, one of Adnan's friends; Imran, a Woodlawn student and also a member of the mosque; and Jen Pusateri. The cops also tried to serve Tayyib to have him testify before the grand jury. Tayyib is the friend of Jay, also a member of the mosque. And according to Jay, in his interviews, Adnan had confessed to Tayyib, although Jay seems to think that Adnan didn't tell him who he'd killed, only that he had killed someone. However, the cops couldn't find Tayyib. According to their notes, their attempts to serve him were met with negative results, and he was ultimately never talked to, either by the detectives or interviewed before the grand jury. Adnan's brother, Tanvir, was also noted in the police's progress reports as someone they wanted to serve so that he could testify before the grand jury, but it's unclear if he ever actually did so.
Yeah, on the other hand, we know one witness who absolutely did not testify before the grand jury. We've said this before, but Jay, obviously the chief witness for the prosecution at trial, was not called before the grand jury. We do have a progress report from April 13th, which is the day that the grand jury returned the indictment. And it says basically that detectives confronted Jay before that indictment was issued about inconsistencies in his story. And so you can infer from that probably one or both of the detectives talked to him, got his story at least in manageable shape, and then testified before the grand jury. Again, those notes, the transcript of those testimonies were never produced to the defense. And I would really like to see that because, you know, the defense claimed that they should be able to get discovery of it. They never did. I would love to see whether Jay's story was meaningfully different, at least as relayed by the cops. Now, of course, hearsay admissible before the grand jury, they're relaying what he said, but we don't know what he said during that final interview on April 13th.
And we also know from the Ezra Mabel case and his allegations, and just to remind you, Mabel was one of the cases we discussed in the Charm City episode. He had also been accused and convicted of murder, and the case was investigated by Detective Ritz. He was ultimately released because of apparent significant wrongdoing on the part of the investigators. One of the claims from Mabel is that Detective Ritz, in fact, went before a grand jury and lied about what two witnesses had said and falsely claimed that those two witnesses had ID'd Mabel as the killer, even when they hadn't. So given that background, like Colin, I'd be very curious to see what either Ritz or McGillivray testified to before the grand jury. Looking at this list, here's what we know. There were only two witnesses who provided any evidence of Adnan's guilt at the grand jury proceeding. Because Saad, Yasser, and Imran Bilal, none of them had anything to say linking Adnan to the murder. That left Jin and then the detectives if they testified at the grand jury as well. So there wasn't really much evidence put forth of Adnan's guilt and no direct evidence other than the hearsay evidence from Jin and the detectives.
Just to be clear, the defense never, and to this day, we have never gotten copies of Jen's grand jury testimony or whatever detective testified. We have no idea what they said. So before we get into Bilal's testimony, let me just give you some background on who he was. Now, I met Bilal, I think it was in the early 1990s, when we lived out in Western Maryland, not close to Baltimore. And he had moved to the area with his mother from Saudi Arabia. He was a few years older than me. He was very active in the mosque, and he mostly organized events for young boys, like the youth. He would do like overnight camps and youth camps and things of that sort. And as, you know, we got older, I went off to college, and Bilal and his family also, his mother moved to the Baltimore area, as did my family. And he also got very involved in the mosque in Baltimore. And because he was older than all of us by a number of years, much older than Adnan and Saad, he often would help some of these kids that he was mentoring or, you know, whatever, giving guidance or whatever, with things that they couldn't do, like, for example, getting them a cell phone. So he was not only the one who got Adnan his phone, he arranged things for other kids too. He had gotten apparently some of the other kids' cars in his name because they couldn't get a car, maybe because of credit reasons or for whatever reasons, but they were close friends of his. And I know this because I recently spoke to his ex-wife, and his ex-wife is the woman who was married to him actually in 1999. They had been married for about a year before they separated, and we'll talk about those circumstances later. But as all this was happening, when Adnan was arrested, he was married to this lady, and we spoke at length. And she's the one who told me that, you know, it wasn't just Adnan. Bilal was helping out a lot of other kids in the area too. He also, however, took the lead in organizing for Adnan's defense. He was one of the first people that Adnan's mother called when Adnan was arrested, because she trusted Bilal, and she often asked him to please counsel Adnan and talk to him about girls and dating and these things. So he was very much a part of the fundraising, and he took the lead on finding the attorneys. So in fact, there's a letter that was issued from the president of the mosque at that time, and it's dated March 23rd, 1999. It's not clear who it's issued to, but it might have been a letter giving Bilal some authority in the community to help organize for Adnan. So this should give you an idea of his role. And this is what it says. It says, "To whom it may concern, please be informed that Bilal is providing extraordinary assistance to the parents, family of Adnan Sayed in the present crisis. Upon the family's recommendation, we have requested Bilal to continue his full support and work closely with the family in coordinating efforts of this community towards unbiased, equitable justice for Adnan Sayed."
The investigators would have known of Bilal's significance in this case from a very early stage, because Bilal was the one who helped Adnan get his cell phone. It was his name that the service was under, and on the cell phone records that the police subpoenaed, it has Bilal's name listed on the very first page. So I'm sure the cops got that and wondered, well, why is Adnan's phone obtained through this Bilal person? So they knew who he was, but the first recorded instance in which they talked to him was on March 16th, when they go by to give him a grand jury subpoena and also have a discussion with him. We don't know about what, they didn't take notes, but somehow, some way, as of March 16th, they decided that Bilal was someone they want the grand jury, and they think he has something to say that's useful to the case, possibly. As we mentioned in a previous episode, the next day, on March 17th, in the notes from Jay's ride-along interview, the cops also write down Bilal's name, and somewhat near it, they also write, "going to discredit." It's unclear what the connection is or what the notes are referring to, but for some reason, Bilal was heavily on their minds, likely because of what he said on March 16th.
Jay recently gave his interview to The Intercept, and here's what he had to say. "I know that during the grand jury, there was a spiritual leader of the mosque. I don't know how to pronounce his name, something with a B. Editors note we'll refer to this person as Mr. B. He spoke with the police during the investigation. But when he was called to the grand jury, he pled the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination through testimony. So whatever he knew about Adnan, he knew that if he said it in court, he could also be in trouble." Now that leads to a couple of interesting points. The first being, how does Jay have any information about this? As I said before, grand jury proceedings are secretive. The witnesses aren't supposed to share what they said. The grand jurors aren't, but also the prosecutors aren't supposed to say what happened. The police officers aren't there for the grand jury testimony. So what this means is someone broke the rules of the grand jury and relayed some type of information to Jay that he shouldn't have possessed.
It's also factually incorrect regarding pleading the fifth because Bilal did testify, but it might have been that Jay was confusing that with the motion to quash. Could that be possible?
It doesn't sound like it to me. He's talking about the grand jury and saying that Bilal pled the fifth when Bilal actually testified, although he did. Sorry, what's the phrase? He does reserve his rights.
Basically, it's kind of interesting. Every single time he's asked a question, he says, you know, without waiving my Fifth Amendment privilege, but then he responds to the question, which is sort of meaningless, but he does invoke it in the sense that he mentions it, but then he does answer the questions that he's asked.
Yeah, I don't know why he's doing that. That's not pleading the fifth, because he does answer the questions, which is the exact opposite of invoking the fifth.
Well, I can tell you why he's doing that, because Saad was also represented by Gutierrez at the time, and she told them to do that. I mean, so they were advised that this is how you're going to respond. I remember my brother telling me that.
That's bizarre. So this is Gutierrez doing that. I've never heard of that happening, and it's completely ineffective. I mean, I don't know what her thought process was, but you can't immunize your testimony by having a preface that invokes the Fifth Amendment because you're going on and answering the question.
I'm trying to think of a practical explanation for why an attorney would say this, and I'm coming up empty.
Well, if you read the testimony, it's really difficult to read because of that. With every single question, they repeat this line. And many times they say, I'm going to, you know, refer to my counsel, or there's something of that language too. I think it really drags out the testimony, but I don't know. They were both advised by their attorney to do so.
The most interesting and telling part of Jay's statement, however, in the Intercept interview to me is when he says that, you know, if Mr. B testifies at trial, he could get in trouble. Now, we're going to get into the content of Bilal's testimony in a minute, but pay attention to that, because that means that somebody has told Jay, perhaps the same person who gave him information about the sealed grand jury testimony, but somebody has told him that if Bilal repeats what he said at the grand jury at the trial, he could get in trouble for it. The real question here is, who would he get in trouble with? Let's first take a look at the content of his grand jury testimony.
It's all over the place. I mean, most of the questions just address general mundane issues about, did Anon tell you he was dating someone? Did Anon tell you about the homecoming dance incident?
A number of the questions also discussed his conversations with Anon about dating and sex. Obviously, how did he know Anon? What was their relationship? And I thought I pulled a few of the more interesting questions about, like, knowledge of the crime or victim. Like, did Anon ever talk about Hay after her body was found? And so here's a few of the questions that I thought were interesting. The question was, when Heyman was missing, Adnan called to say that Heyman was missing. So Bilal said, who is Heyman Lee? And Adnan said, it's the person I'm seeing. And Vicky Walsh, who was the prosecutor, said, you said he showed concern. What concern did he show? And Bilal's answer was, I got the impression he was worried, surprised, concerned. Then Vicky asked, did there come a time when there was a conversation or telephone call where her body was recovered? Answer, yes. And Vicky asked, what was the conversation? And the answer was, he was crying. He found out she was dead. And my personal favorite question from Vicky, which we don't have an answer to, but the question is telling, and that is, so you're telling me Adnan didn't tell you that he participated in the murder of Heyman Lee? A lot of the questions were also about Bilal's role in the community and his own behavior. Like, was he advising young people on Islamic issues? You know, why did he get them phones?
And these questions are not what you'd expect. For instance, here's one segment from Bilal's grand jury testimony. Question, did you register at a homestyle inn in your name? Answer, yes. Question, do you recall when? Answer, no. Question, December 9, 1992. Does that refresh your recollection? Answer, possible, but I don't remember. What relevance could it possibly have to Anand's case whether Bilal stayed at a homestyle inn in 1992, 7 years before the murder?
The big question here is, are we completely missing some narrative in this story? Because at the time this is taking place, the stories are either Edmondson Avenue or Best Buy. Like, there's no hotel that comes up in any statement we've seen where that's a murder site or anything like that. So what's the relevance that Vicky Wash is looking for here?
I think there were literally like 18 questions about his hotel usage and registration.
It can't be about Anand's case. Whatever they're fishing for, it has nothing to do with Anand and something about Bilal that they want to know or they want to convey to him.
Yeah, I mean, this is what you'd refer to in the legal field as a fishing expedition. It seems more than anything that Vicky Wash here is just casting a wide net and hoping it picks something up. But I mean, this is not directed questioning that has really a tight connection here to anything involved in this case.
Now, we've talked about the role of Adnan's religion and culture in this case. It came up at the bail hearing. It certainly came up at trial later, and we'll get to that. But it also came up during the grand jury questioning. And some of those questions, I mean, are just ridiculous and completely irrelevant. And I'm not quite sure what the purpose of them was, but I'll give you an example. This is another portion of Bilal's testimony. How many times do you pray or prayer per day? Answer 5. Is there a specific posture? What direction do you face? The answer is northeast, towards the house of Abraham, or as we commonly refer to it, Mecca. Who are you praying to? Answer, God. And then there's a lady in the grand jury who asks, up to what age do children stop Sunday school? The answer is 14, 15. And then some very relevant questions, which speak to me because they tell me kind of what is really being explored here with these questions on Islam and culture. Is there any punishment for dating outside the Islamic society in the Quran? Answer, no, there's no distinction between inside or outside. Dating does not equal adultery, which is forbidden by the Quran, but dating is too close for comfort to adultery, so it's frowned upon. Another question, what is the penalty if someone dates outside the Islamic community? The answer, it doesn't matter if inside or outside the community. And also there's an offer to marry the person in our community. We have no penalty for that. So the fact that there were a significant amount of questions about Islamic practices and attitudes towards dating and sex and all of these things inside and outside the community means that the grand jury was also oriented towards this as a motive. I mean, that's what it seems like to me. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, at this point in the case, you know, as Susan said before, all we have is hearsay before the grand jury. Vicky Wash is the prosecutor presenting it to the grand jury. She is the one you might recall who made the misstatements at the bail hearing and later had to apologize for those. I think you're exactly right, Rabia. She knew she had a weak case. And we know from timing, it's not until April 13th when finally the detectives presumably relay what Jay has had to say that the grand jury indicts. It's a fishing expedition. I think she's trying to do what she can to get this indictment, and putting this motive forward is the best attempt that she can do to convince the grand jurors that there's probable cause here.
And she was also convinced that Anand had confessed to one of these people. From the notes, from the transcripts, we can tell that one of her big concerns was that Anand had, in her belief, absolutely confessed to someone, and she wanted to find out who, which is why she brought in all the Muslim friends that she could find rather than people who actually knew anything about the case.
Well, that comes from Jay, right, Susan? There's, at least in one of his interviews, if I'm recalling correctly, Jay says he's in the car with Adnan. He doesn't remember who it was, but Adnan was on the phone saying he had killed someone. So I guess she's maybe following up on another of Jay's stories and thinking, well, there must be someone that he knows on his phone log who he has confessed to.
Yeah, well, it might have been Yasser. He called Yasser sometimes. It might have been Tanvir, his brother, because of course his brother would help cover up a murder. Not in Saad. Saad's also a friend. Gutierrez's notes from Saad's grand jury testimony, it says, state alleges defendant must have confessed to him.
So they were really fishing to find that person that Adnan had confessed to, it seems.
I think they're fishing for a lot, but that's one of the things.
But Bilal's most important testimony, to me at least, and I'm sure to the state, was not really about some of the other things they explored, but it was about whether or not he had seen Adnan on the evening of the 13th, the day that Hay disappeared. Now, I have to give you a little bit of background about what's happening in Ramadan, because this was the month of Ramadan in the Muslim community, and how that operates. Now, Ramadan is a month that happens every year for 29 or 30 days. It's on a lunar calendar and it moves. So every year it moves back 10 days. Now, in 1999, Ramadan fell in the month of January, February. The way it works is Muslims fast from sunup to sundown, but every evening there are special prayers said in Ramadan that are not said any other time during the year. They are called Taraweeh prayers, but I know that's maybe too much information. But anyway, the way they work is that if you've seen Muslims pray, you know it's a very physical prayer. You're standing up, you're going all the way to the floor, you're back up. And to lessen the physical exertion, they're broken up into units of two. So there'll be a cycle of two stand-ups, you know, prostrate, stand up, and then there's breaks in between. In Ramadan, those evening prayers can last a long time, between 1 and 2 hours. And in the middle of those prayers, most mosques will often take a prolonged break. So let's say you have 10 units of prayer, you take a half an hour break, then you do another 10 units just to give people time to stretch, you know. But, and I posted a video from this past Ramadan on my blog a couple of months ago to show how even as the prayers are ongoing, people are coming in and out and, you know, it's very active. You're not stuck, basically, in the prayer. You can move around if you need to. So apparently what the Baltimore Mosque was doing at the time was in that break, in that longer break in the middle of the prayer, instead of kids just loitering around, they had asked them, they had decided to put them to some work, and they asked different kids to give a presentation to the other kids, and they assigned them for different nights. Adnan was assigned to present during the evening prayer, during that break, for the 14th. The next day. And Bilal testifies at the grand jury that he remembers seeing Adnan the evening before, meaning the evening of the 13th at the mosque, and going over the notes that Adnan had prepared for the following day's presentation.
Yeah, so let me read from the notes from Bilal's grand jury testimony. 13th, prepare for 14th prayer service, 14th prayer service with 20 other boys. Did you have occasion to see defendant on January 13th? Answers any evening, didn't recall time, about a specific prayer, next day, Ramadan explained. So basically what Bilal is saying is, I recall on January 13th going over Adnan with the prayers he was going to lead in the 14th. And in fact, in the defense files, we have those notes that presumably Adnan and Bilal were going over on the night of the 13th, which, you know, it's huge because a big part of the prosecution's theory of the case is that Adnan was not at the mosque, that he was burying Hay's body in Lincoln Park with Jay. And yet here we have Bilal with a very clear recollection and a meaningful recollection of, no, he was at the mosque with me preparing for prayers the next day. I have a specific recollection of this taking place.
But a little further down in the notes, the question is raised that on the 14th, you saw the defendant leading prayer at what time? And Bilal responds that it was the night prayer, meaning that special Ramadan night prayer at 8 p.m. So it's interesting to me that, you know, Bilal now has nailed down a time, and this is not a long time after Ramadan has passed. And that's important because, as I explained, Ramadan moves, the timings change as it moves. When Ramadan happens in the summer months, those prayers can start at 10 o'clock at night. When it happens in the winter months, they can start at 6 p.m. And it also depends on the mosque, but Bilal has a very specific recollection very shortly after Ramadan ended that year that it was 8 p.m.
So after the grand jury testimony from Bilal, the state wasn't done with him. The next thing they did was to request Bilal's cell phone records. In fact, they got the DEA to help them with that. The DEA, not Baltimore, subpoenaed Bilal's cell phone records from Sprint and received them on April 30th, 1999. I have no idea why they wanted the cell phone records, or what they thought they'd show, or why they waited until April to request them, but they went to considerable effort to obtain them, which means that for some reason, there was something about the cell phone records that the cops thought might be very important for their case. It's also worth noting that those cell phone records they obtained did contain the numbers of incoming callers. Unlike Adnan's cell phone records, which did not come complete with incoming call numbers, for Bilal at least, they decided they wanted to obtain those incoming call numbers and were able to do so. As the case went on, Bilal was clearly a vital witness for the defense, and Adan's defense had every intent of calling him at trial. He was listed as a witness for the defense in their filings, although the prosecution also claimed him as a state's witness. Why? Because in their filings, they stated that they reserve the right to call anyone as a witness who had been named in the pleadings or in their disclosures, which did include Bilal because he'd been named by the defense. So yeah, in that sense, he was a state's witness, but it's clear that Adnan wanted to call him and intended to do so because he proved the alibi for Adnan for the evening of January 13th. However, Yurik too was interested in what Bilal had to say. And in August, Yurik wrote a letter to Bilal stating, "You have been identified as an important witness in the above captured case, which is currently scheduled for trial on October 13th, 1999. In order that I may discuss the facts of the case and arrange your availability with as little disruption of your normal activities as possible, I would appreciate it if you would call me as soon as possible at the above number." After that letter, Bilal contacted the defense to tell him about it. He was still cooperating with them, still their witness, and still happy to share information with them that he'd obtained, which in this case included the fact that Yurik had apparently decided that he was important to the case.
So I have been communicating with Bilal directly through email, but also through a mutual friend and one of his relatives. And I've asked him about this particular meeting, and the responses are a little bit unclear because on one hand, he has said that there was no meeting and that Gutierrez made sure it didn't happen, which made me think that maybe he's confusing the grand jury time when she was representing him with this August meeting that was called for. Because at another time he said, well, I never met with a man, but I met with a woman. You know, so it seems like he did meet with a woman from the state, but his recollection is that he doesn't remember meeting any male representative like Yurik from the state. But again, his response to that are not quite clear. He also seemed to think for some reason that this meeting was called later after the trials and like the following year or something. And so there's a little bit of confusion about this. And I don't know if it's just been because it's been so many years, but he does have a very specific recollection about meeting a woman from the state. And from the documents we have in the files, I don't see any indication of any other time that would have been. Like, I don't see any other request to meet with him or any other notes that he had met with anybody from the state other than this time.
Yeah, I mean, clearly he met with Vicky Wash in the sense that she interrogated him before the grand jury. But beyond that, yeah, no indication of any type of meeting.
We know that even after August, though, Bilal was still close to the defense. He was still intending to be their witness and was still fully available to them to talk to. The last record we have of Bilal and the defense communicating comes from a memo dated September 29th, which is just a simple note to Gutierrez saying, "Bilal called. This is his new number. He's returning the call from your clerk." So the original trial date for Adnan was scheduled on October 13th, 1999. On October 13th, however, Gutierrez had raised a motion for a continuance in that she wanted more time to prepare and to review evidence because she hadn't seen things like the diary. So on October 13th, they go to court. The motion is initially denied. And Adnan's trial is set to continue the following day, October 14th, before Judge Quarles. On October 14th, Kevin Yurik makes his first and last Brady disclosure to the defense.
On that date, Kevin Yurik sends the defense an amended state's disclosure, and it states in relevant part, pursuant to Brady versus Maryland, the state provides the following. On this date, the state received an oral report from Baltimore County police officers that state's witness, Bilal, was arrested earlier this day and charged with a fourth degree sex offense. That's it. That's the only Brady disclosure that Yurik ever made. I'm not really sure why it's considered Brady material. I mean, it is in the sense that if Bilal were going to testify against Adnan,
it's impeachment.
It could be used to impeach, but not really, because it's not a crime of dishonesty or false statement. It's not relevant factually in terms of the murder trial. I don't see any way in which this would be admissible, let alone material. So it's a strange disclosure that he's making, especially when he hasn't made other Brady disclosures in the case.
Yeah, it's hard to see how this could actually be Brady. But it does seem clear that Yurik was very eager to disclose it, because he discloses it the same day it happens. Which also raises an interesting question, because how did Yurik know about it? On October 14th, officers from Baltimore County Police went and arrested Bilal. And yet, somehow that same day, the Baltimore County officers knew to communicate this to a prosecutor in Baltimore in a case that, to the Baltimore County officers, seemed totally unrelated to Bilal's arrest. And yet, somehow, Eric knew about it instantly.
Just as a reminder, in terms of the Brady disclosures, I mean, at this point, Eric has not turned over, for example, Jay's various statements, which are much more, I would think, considered like Brady. You know what I mean? He hasn't turned over all these other things that were possibly Brady material, but here we have him turning this over. And it seems like the only possible reason for him to do that is he really wanted to call this to the Gutierrez's attention, right? Like, he wanted her to know something about what's happening with one of their witnesses. So could this have been an intimidation tactic, right? Warning the defense that one of their alibi witnesses is off the table.
Yeah, I mean, to me, my first thought when I saw this was that it looks like a plea negotiation tactic. You're now at the 11th hour. This trial is going to happen. Maybe you don't want to go to trial because you want to settle it or plead it out. What better way to try and force a last minute settlement than announcing on the eve of trial, by the way, your alibi witness just got arrested for sex offense. As far as we know, Eric never sought out a plea deal, so that wouldn't fit, but
there was some game being played here. I mean, not just your alibi, but really your only alibi witness, right? I mean, like, at this point, Gutierrez has nobody else that she's lined up to account for Adnan's day.
It's so strange. I mean, he knows Gutierrez previously represented Bilal. She was there for the grand jury testimony. She knows he's not going to say anything incriminatory against Adnan. So as a Brady disclosure, this makes no sense. If you just look at it and you take it as it's supposed to be, it doesn't, on its own terms, make any rational sense. So there has to be some type of pretext here, and there's a deeper meaning, and it might very well be what you're saying. I mean, I can't really look at it and make heads or tails of it. Maybe our listeners can, but I mean, certainly what you say is as plausible as anything.
So let's talk about the underlying incident that this charge is referring to, fourth degree sexual misconduct. Now, in 1999, as I mentioned earlier, Bilal had been married. And when this incident happened, he had been married roughly a year. But there were disturbing rumors about him in the community involving him and young boys. There were rumors. But it wasn't until he was arrested that year. And when that happened, when this arrest took place on October 14th, the community became aware of it. And I remember, I mean, I wasn't even living in Maryland, but I was even made aware of it through other people. And when I spoke to his ex-wife, what she remembered about that day was that he was arrested that morning and he was gone all day. She had no idea what was going on. She was home alone. She just knew something was up and she wasn't informed that he had been arrested. And he came home in the evening. So he was released the same day and that he was very panicked. And then that evening, shortly after he came home, a police car came and parked outside of their home and was there all night. And Bilal was very nervous and he told her to turn off all the lights and close the blinds. And she asked him what's going on. And he said that they're just harassing me because I'm Muslim. Don't worry about it, but I don't want them to know what's happening inside the house. So let's not let them see. I thought that was interesting when I heard it, because what possible reason could the police have to be sitting outside his home all night? What do you guys think of that?
Nothing makes sense about this. There's a piece we're missing, and until we have it, I don't think it's possible to put it all together. But it's clear there was some connection. Eric was concerned about it. Eric knew about it very fast. He made a Brady disclosure about it. Something was going on here.
Well, a day or two later, Bilal and his mother encouraged his wife to go out of town for a little bit. They said, "We need you to leave." She still didn't know what was going on, so she went and stayed with her mother for a bit. And it just so happened that her older brother had a friend in the police department in Baltimore, and it's unclear whether it was city or county, but this man called her brother and said, "Listen, there's this guy who's been caught up in these charges, and for some reason, his name sounds familiar. Is this your sister's husband?" And her brother confirmed it, yes. And then that officer confirmed the charges. And that's when she first learned of what had happened, that there had been an incident and he had been found in a compromising position with a young boy that, in fact, she knew. She knew this young boy because he had come to her home many times. He was tutored by him. And he was, according to her and according to other sources in the community, which I've confirmed at least five different times from five different people, a 14-year-old Bosnian refugee child. Now, this is what's really confusing about this, is that if indeed that is what happened and Bilal was in fact caught abusing a 14-year-old child, what you would naturally expect next is that he is going to be charged and he is going to be tried for it. But that's not what happened. The charges were dropped. And very shortly thereafter, Bilal left the country and he did not return for a number of years. So by the time the trial rolled around in December and Gutierrez was subpoenaing him, he was nowhere to be found. When his wife became aware of the incident, she essentially did not return to the marriage. She stayed with her family in Atlanta. Then she went and stayed with another brother in another part of the country. At that time, she started exploring options for a divorce. And this is kind of interesting. She wanted to know exactly what had happened with the case. What was the posture of the case? Was he going to be charged or what had happened? And she also wanted to be able to include this in her divorce complaint. So apparently she called the Baltimore County police and asked, you know, what happened here? I need to know because I'm going through a divorce proceeding with this man and I need to know exactly what happened. And she was told that the case was dropped because the alleged victim was not 14. The alleged victim was in fact not a minor and was older than they had assumed him to be. This was very puzzling to her, and to this day, she maintains that that's absolutely not true, that he, in fact, was 14 years old. And yesterday, I also spoke to somebody who was a very prominent member of the community and sat on the board of the mosque. And this gentleman also knew this child in question, this Bosnian kid, and he says that absolutely unequivocally, he was 14 years old. He came in as a refugee. His documents showed he was 14, and we all know he was 14. So, you know, what we have here is a situation where if we are connecting the dots right, that the state's attorney prosecuting Adnan took a special interest in Bilal, sought him out. He was arrested the day the trial was supposed to begin, but then charges were dropped and suddenly he became unavailable to testify as Adnan's defense witness. That's disturbing if we are to make the assumption that there's a connection there and he was offered some kind of a deal or just told that, listen, get out of here, don't testify for the defense, and we're going to drop these charges. But it's also really disturbing if you think about the fact that there might have been a 14-year-old victim who did not get justice then.
It's tough to imagine what's going on here. For them to have arrested him, they must have had reason to believe that this was a 14-year-old minor. That's a pretty easy thing to be able to check. And from what you're saying, Rabia, it seems clear that this victim in the case was 14. So I don't know how they got from the arrest to the charges being dropped based upon uncertainty about the age. It's another one of those situations where you're wondering whether smoke is there fire. And as you say, it's a horrible situation either way. If this was sort of used to prevent him from testifying on the one hand, on the other hand, if they're not bringing to justice the perpetrator of child molestation, that is disturbing. You know, there's something disturbing either way, and we're not quite sure what's going on here, but it's certainly disconcerting no matter how you slice it.
When I think about how Bilal reacted to all of this, that he didn't just leave the country for a little bit, he left the country for a number of years. To me, that is some major fear. And it seems like he felt very intimidated. I mean, if you have police cars parked outside of your house for absolutely no reason, that would certainly be intimidating. And if you have state's attorney issuing subpoenas for your records using the DEA, because that's what we have. We have DEA issued subpoenas for Bilal's phone records. I'm sure that's also very intimidating. So the bottom line, though, for Adnan here was that when he needed somebody to come testify that he was in fact at the mosque on the evening of the 13th, he no longer had that witness available to him.
Yeah, and imagine what would have happened if the jury heard from Bilal. Potentially, it could have directly contradicted what Jay said about the Lincoln Park burial. Even if we think that happened a little bit earlier, still you have this member of the mosque saying, you know, around 8 o'clock on the 13th, Adnan's at the mosque. He's acting normal. We're going over the prayers he's leading the next day. If you're a jury, you have to imagine that that would be fairly compelling evidence. Unless you reach the conclusion that this is maybe like a cold-hearted sociopath, it's hard to imagine him being at the mosque and preparing to lead prayers, acting normal right after everything that Jay said went down.
And just to be clear, it's not that Bilal didn't testify for Adnan because he didn't stand by his testimony from the grand jury, but because as recently, literally as just this week, in an email that he sent me, he said that if there was another trial, he absolutely would come and testify that he saw Adnan on the 13th. So he stood by that statement. He didn't change that part of the statement. So there was another reason that he didn't show up. And that's really what seems like one thing, but we just don't have confirmation on it.
Yeah, and we can tie this all back around once again to Gutierrez. I mean, Rabia, what you're saying is he's always been willing to testify. Obviously, there were some issues back in 1999 and he couldn't be tracked down at the time of trial. There's a rule of evidence. It's Maryland Rule of Evidence 5-804B1. It allows for the admission of former testimony as an exception to the rule against hearsay. If, in fact, Gutierrez did all she could to try to bring Bilal to testify and he was simply unreachable, she certainly could have introduced a transcript of his testimony before the grand jury establishing that mosque alibi, but she failed to do that. Hopefully, based upon everything going on now, there's justice done, a new trial is ordered. For other reasons, I don't think that trial is going to take place, but it certainly is interesting and compelling that Bilal is saying very recently that he's still willing to testify on behalf of Adnan.
I have always thought that this case is so much stranger than fiction, and not just because of the lack of any hard, real facts, and not just because so many things are ambiguous enough to look one way or the complete opposite way, and not just because of the incredibly poor investigation and documentation in which we're missing things as simple and as obvious as incoming call numbers for Adnan's cell phone, the records for Hayes' pager, and a ton of other relevant evidence. But what makes this case, this story, the absolute strangest to me is the people involved, an intersection of a really odd cast of characters, if you will. From the self-contradictory paradox that is Jay, to the oddity that is Mr. S and the way he found Hay's body, to Mandy, the unqualified expert on Islam and Muslims who clearly impacted the course of the investigation, and of course, Bilal. I've spoken to at least half a dozen people who have known Bilal for the last 2 decades, and they all agree that Bilal as a person, his relationship to the case and to the community, are a deeply discomforting enigma. He both endeared himself to the young boys, but made people in the community very uneasy. He both took the lead in organizing for Adnan's defense, but then disappeared when it mattered the most. One person, a former president of the mosque, told me there were different rumors in the community about why Bilal took off. Some people thought he may have taken money from Adnan's legal fund, which he was managing, and got caught. Some thought he was so distraught about his wife filing for divorce that he left. Others thought he fled because he wanted to escape prison for molesting minors, while yet others wondered if he must have cut a deal with the authorities because he had never spent a day in jail for his misdeeds. Now, our MPI requests from the Baltimore County Police Department on this incident have gone, like most others, unanswered. But we haven't yet hit a dead end for absolute evidence proving some kind of deal was struck between the authorities and Bilal. And if and when we get it, we will let you all know. But for my part, based on what we do have, I draw my conclusion this way. There is literally no reason for the Baltimore County Police Department to contact the Baltimore City prosecutor in Adnan's case about Bilal's arrest. Why would they do that? How would they even know of his connection to the case? The county had handed over the case and the investigation to the city 8 months earlier. Especially when the charges here, sexual misconduct with a minor,
are completely unrelated to the murder investigation. It wasn't like they found evidence linking Bilal to the crime and had to alert authorities in the jurisdiction handling the case. They contacted the team prosecuting Adnan, and the only reason they would do so is because they knew that Yurik would want or need this information. And I can't help but personally conclude that Yurik expected it, because he and the police were looking for a way to nail Bilal and to find some leverage on him, which they did. But the cast of Stranger Than Fiction players in this case doesn't end here. We have yet to discuss the woman who held Adnan's life in her hands, who spent decades celebrated in the legal community, but ended her career in complete tatters. Christina Gutierrez. Next time on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Our production consultant is Rebecca Lavoie. She's a true crime author and hosts the podcast Crime Writers on Serial. Dennis Robinson is our producer, and you can find us online on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.